Welcome to the Imagine Israel podcast, brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington. Imagine Israel is the initiative of the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, which connects Washingtonians to Israel and Israelis through the lens of social change. With every Imagine Israel podcast, we get to meet with innovative Israeli influencers and changemakers, people addressing social and economic challenges in Israel. We'll hear from people whose lives and whose work intersect as they address issues in Israeli society. I'm your host, Robbie Greengrass, and I'm coming to you from Makom, the Israel Education Lab of the Jewish Agency for Israel. And also, just to let you know, in parallel with the podcast, the Jewish Federation's Imagine Israel Changemakers series is actually bringing innovative Israelis to Washington, like physically you'll get to meet them, so they can share how their life and their work and their passions intersect to make a real substantial impact on Israeli society. So you are invited to the next Imagine Israel speaker series. Dr. Dalia Fadila is coming to DC in February 2017. She is an amazing woman on a mission to empower Arab Israeli citizens and advance the status of women through education. And she's pioneered a revolutionary schooling system in Israel. Really worth meeting and listening to. All the details you can find on www.shalomdc.org/changemakers, all one word. And to our episode this time round. This episode of the Imagine Israel podcast is dedicated to the memory of Bambi Shelig, an Israeli journalist and activist who died far too soon. Bambi was an orthodox woman with an unorthodox mind. In the occasional chats that I had the honour of having with her, she was always far more gentle and warm than her ferocious reputation suggested. I was always touched and inspired by my conversations with her, but no more so than when she talked to me about pizza. You see, according to Bambi, the ultimate symbol of Israeli society is not the menorah nor the Star of David. The ultimate symbol of Israeli society is the pizza. Now, imagine a pizza, okay? In fact, imagine Bambi sitting down opposite you, pulling out a piece of paper and drawing a pizza. Okay, so imagine this like a circle divided up with diametrical lines. Yeah, kind of divide into slices. And then imagine another circle right at the outer edge of this pizza circle, kind of the crust. Okay, so you've got the crust and the pizza divided up into slices. So according to Bambi's pizza, Israel is divided into distinct sectors, like slices of a pizza. But the different slices of Israeli society do not communicate with each other directly. They only hear about each other and talk to each other through the media. And the media, think about the crust at the outside of the pizza, the media only reports what it hears from the very extreme edges of each slice. It only reports on the extreme voices, okay? So you've got the pizza, the extreme edges of the crust, slices only hearing about other slices through the crusty extremes, which, if we're really going to extend this metaphor, also tend to be far less textured and tasty. But look at this. This is what Bambi would point out with her pencil on the diagram. Look at this pizza. You see here, close to the centre of the pizza, this is where the slices are closest together, at the centre of the pizza, and that's the point. The moderates of each slice, the ones who are closer to the middle of the pizza, are actually closer to the moderates from other slices. In fact, they're closer to the moderates from other slices than they are to the extremists of their own slice. So a moderate Haredi ultra-Orthodox woman probably has more in common with a moderate Arab woman than she does with an extremist Haredi ultra-Orthodox activist from her own sector. A moderate leftist is closer to the moderate settler than to the rejectionist left. So for those of us here and those of you there in Washington, this episode of Imagine Israel is dedicated to this vision of Bambi's pizza. We're going to be chatting with Chaya Gilboa from Jerusalem, an amazing activist who's working to bridge the gap between moderates from different slices of the population. And as you'll hear, her struggle is both personal and political, both religious and progressive, which is often the way when you address issues of the Jewish religion in Israel. Because here we have a government ministry of religion, and the rabbinate overlooking religious affairs for Jews. The rabbinate interprets halakha, Jewish religious law, interprets halakha through a strictly orthodox, if not ultra-orthodox, lens. Okay, so there's no separation going on here. Here, religion is political, and politics are often religious. So I walked up the road from, I guess you may know, the Inbal Hotel in Jerusalem, past the Jerusalem Theatre, and over to Chaya's office in the stately premises of the Hartman Institute, all stones and steps, to talk with her about her unusual life and unusual approach to pizza. Hello, Chaya.
Shalom.
Shalom. So first of all, I wanted to talk to you just a little bit about being Jewish, because I have to say, where I was born, back in the UK, some many centuries ago, being Jewish was a pretty simple thing. You know, you're either Jewish or you're not. Same kind of simplicity for you when you were
So I grew up in a different, I think, world. That's how I say. I always say that today I live in Jerusalem, in Rehavia, which is one of the, I think, still the secular neighborhood that we have in Jerusalem. And I drive every other Shabbat to my parents' house for Shabbat dinner, and I drive like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. But I always say that it's like, let's say, 15 minutes drive, but you cross like 400 years. And it's really what it feels. So I grew up in a very religious neighborhood in Jerusalem, in Har Nof, which is on the west side of Jerusalem, a Haredi, ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. My dad is very ultra-Orthodox with all the accessories. And my mom is also, I mean, in a different way, but also there is five of us. I'm the only person that defines himself, I think, practically secular, but very Jewish in my mind. But growing up, it was a very different experience than it is today. And I think especially is because growing up as a woman in a very religious world, you don't really feel Jewish. I think you more feel like it's a subjective experience, but I felt like a follower. Like, I was never participating in anything. I was never oh, wow. like part of the, let's say, active force in the community. I was not a player. I was a watcher, can I say that? Someone who watched the play. And it was hard for me. And it's funny because I remember myself in the age of 14 kind of telling my dad, I don't want to be secular. I want to be religious, but I need to have a space. I want to have a voice. I want to be Jewish. But in my community, it was less, there was no room for that.
And how did your dad respond? How does he respond?
Well, I think it was hard for him to hear that, because I think part of him respected me for this voice. It's not like I want to go and party on Shabbat and I want to smoke, whatever. It wasn't the conversation. I said
that's probably
I wanna
far more difficult, in fact.
Yes, but I think he did respect me. But I think he didn't have any answer. Like the two things that he was very concerned about is like what the community will say if my daughter will start study Talmud or reading the Torah. Like, he couldn't even think about an option like that, and he was really terrified by what the community will say. Another part of him, like, he's part of the communities. For him, a woman should not take those positions. So he was really against it. And I think it took us many, many years to understand each other. Like today, I am also in a different place mm-hmm. in the relationship that I have with them. I hated school. I felt like we didn't learn anything. Like we learned how to run a kosher kitchen. We learned how to go to dive in the mikveh 7 days, 14 days after my period. Like this is what we study. But I always had questions about the philosophy behind it. And my teachers didn't have the answer. It sounded like they hide something from me.
Yeah.
And they said you should study the practices and like because you need to do it. You don't need to think about it. When you start think about those issues, maybe you will come up with a different.
You start making trouble if you start exactly. asking questions. And so you went. How did you live? was it a tough time?
Yeah, it was a hard time. I think it always. People keep asking me, so when did you leave? And I always say it's like to coming out from a closet. It's but from a Jewish closet. That's what I always say, that Aron HaKodesh. This is the Aron that I left. But
came out of the holy closet.
The holy closet. But it was a process. I think in the age of 16, I explored Tel Aviv, which was really exciting for me. And also explore like other communities in Jerusalem, more like conservative and reform, which in my time was very only like American crazy people. But right. I found like a new voice there that was really interesting to me. And the age of 17, I left. Like practically, I was like all over the country taking hitchhike, traveling from here to there. But only after the army and after I came back from India, I knew.
Oh, you did the India trip. You also went off for your post-army trek around India, like most Israelis do after the army?
Yeah, of course. The Hummus Trail, as we call
it. The Hummus Trail.
you only meet Israelis. It's not really India. It's like you're in Haifa, but the food is less good. I came back from India and I decided I want to go and study Talmud. And I went to my dad and said to him, I need you to support me financially. I'm not going to be able to study in the university. And he said...
In the what?
No, actually, my parents were really happy that all of us went to university. My mom is working at the university, so that's what kept them, I think, in a way more normal. But when I came to my dad and I said, I want to study Talmud, he said, literally, study everything but Talmud, like study Buddhism, study Islam, but don't study Talmud. And I think today I tell my husband that if we're going to have a book that we want my son Michael to read, I'm going to tell him, do not read this book. And I'm going to put it on the highest shelf, but I'm going to make sure you're going to see where I put it. Because I think this is how I will know that he will take the book.
He will definitely
yes.
read it.
So this is what happened to me when my dad say
when
no.
When it was forbidden to read it, therefore you had to.
Yes, yes. And it was amazing 3 years. A very like, not only intellectually, but spiritually, it was a journey. For me, coming back to these ideas, but from a completely different perspective.
So you were a secular woman, or a practically speaking, a secular woman who had emerged from the Haredi world, and you returned to Jewish text.
Yes, yes. And it's not even returning, because for me, it was literally encountering them for the first time, because
right.
it didn't even look like the way we studied in school or in the community.
And so you're sitting here, masses of red hair uncovered, uh-huh. which again is significant because you are married uh-huh. with a kid, and yet hair uncovered, which in Israel is, especially in Jerusalem, in the religious world, is an important signifier that you're not Orthodox, because obviously were you an Orthodox married woman, you'd have your hair covered, free to study whatever Jewish text you want in the best of all possible worlds in
right.
Israel, right?
Well, hopefully, this is how we're going to speak about it in 10 years from now. But it's true. Like, I chose to stay in Jerusalem, which is, I think, it surprised everyone around me. Because after my undergrad, I went to Berkeley for 2 years. I was a shlicha there. And I remember, like, in my time,
So you were a Jewish agency, emissary, for a couple of years.
Yes, in Berkeley.
This would probably be the time to point out that Washington actually has 16 shlichim in the community. 9 of which are part of the Federation's Congregational Shlichim program. So carry on.
Yes.
Okay.
And I was at the time asking Sharansky. He was very much involved in the process because
Natan Sharansky
only...
was the head of the Jewish agency.
Thank you. And I said to him, send me to the most lefty place, you know, in America. And I was in Berkeley finding out that maybe I'm not that lefty because considered to Berkeley. I was pretty conservative, but it was amazing 2 years. And not only that, I dealt a lot with education in Israel and what does it mean to be Jewish in America. One of the, I think for me, fundamental moments was I took a class in Talmud with Professor Daniel Boyarin, and he spoke about the divorce system in Jewish law. And most of the people there were not Jewish, of course, were not Israelis. And they spoke about it as intellectual idea, intellectual exercise. And I was sitting in the class and I literally the whole time I was thinking, it's not an exercise, like it's a reality in Israel and in Jerusalem. And then I was like, this is what I want to do. And I came back to Israel. I studied my MA in public policy, but I did everything, like all of the papers that I wrote were about, not about how to separate state and religion, but how we can create an alternative to what exists today, Jewish alternative that can be pluralistic and egalitarian.
And Jewish, so pluralistic and egalitarian. I mean, that sounds like Reform Jewry.
Well, I must say I'm an ex-Orthodox. So my reading of I think I can't run from it. This is, I spoke Jewish before I spoke Hebrew. Like, this is the way I think. And it's not that I'm not resist to anything. The synagogue I go is more a conservative synagogue than an Orthodox. I think if we want to make change here, we need to create changes within the Orthodoxy community, because this is how, I mean, the state is more Orthodox than anything else.
And the vast majority of Jews in Israel are, if they are religious,
they will go to an Orthodox synagogue. But the rabbinate that control us all think through Orthodoxy prism. Uh-huh. And I think if we want to create an alternative, it can be in like a secular alternative or a reform alternative. It needs to speak the Orthodoxy language, but it needs to be different. So I dealt a lot with like creating another way to get married outside of the rabbinic court, and how you can divorce in more egalitarian way.
Have you seen the film Get?
Yes, of course. I have a class that I teach that we watch the movie and we go back and forth with the Talmudic text. Yes,
it's a film which we'd definitely recommend you guys seeing also in Washington. It's something that I'm sure that you can find on Israel Film Center stream. It may even be on Netflix, I'm not sure.
I think it's on YouTube, the entire movie.
The entire movie, yeah. With an English translation.
I think, yeah.
An amazing movie which gives something of the reality of the theory. For those who haven't yet seen the movie, it's called Get, and it's built around this unbelievable frustration of a man refusing to grant his wife a divorce, and he's backed up by the state's rabbinical courts. Yeah, would that sum it up?
Yeah, yeah.
Is your plan to ruin that movie?
Something that I think keep thinking about, that when you're an activist, you can do things that are far away from your identity and from home, right? You're a part of, like, you rebel against something, you go to the street, but it doesn't really affect your life. But what happened when the thing that you are fighting for, there is a moment that it's intertwined, can I say?
Intertwined.
Yeah. Yeah? To your personal life, and then comes the personal, like the price that you need to pay.
Uh-huh.
And me and my husband, Marek, when we decided to get married, it was very clear to us that we're not going to register through the Rabbanut, the rabbinic court. And we looked for alternative. And sadly, we couldn't find any. It was either to marry in a kibbutz, in a chiloni, in a secular setting, which is not my story, or to go to Cyprus to do a civil ceremony, to come back to Israel and to register as marriage.
Because, of course, in Israel, there's no civil marriage.
Yeah.
And so you either marry according to the Orthodox religion, be it Islam or Judaism or Druze, or you go elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. And so first, we didn't want to register in the rabbinic court. Second, we realized that if we do that, the ceremony is not going to be egalitarian, because the rabbis who perform the ceremonies doesn't think that the ceremonies should be egalitarian. So here I am, standing on a stage in a chuppah, 300 people, because in Israel this is a small wedding.
Of course.
And the woman doesn't speak. I couldn't even think about it. I said, how can I be so far from myself in the most important day of my life?
And I guess at the same time, your parents are going to be under the chuppah?
That's what I wanted. I said, okay. I want everything. I want to be truth to myself, and I want the people that I love and
it's
I care
who you
about.
Are.
Yeah, to be around me. Then I said to my future husband, just let's not register, but let's find a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, that will be agreeing to perform a ceremony without us registering at all, and have a egalitarian chuppah, because in that way my dad will be able also to be there.
And just for our listeners, sometimes you're saying chuppah, the canopy which is stood under during the wedding ceremony, but sometimes chuppah is used as the word for the ceremony itself. The Orthodox religious Jewish marriage ceremony is known as a chuppah. So it's like it's an Orthodox service, but yeah, it's not recognized by the establishment.
Okay. Yes. And we did that after like a long time. We find a brave rabbi. Mm. It wasn't easy, like going, like convincing my family to be there. We paid a price. It was a long, sad months of us fighting about it. Mm. And eventually, many of the people in my family didn't show up. My siblings came and my parents came, but none of the cousins and uncles. And there is many people there that I really love and care about, but we couldn't bridge it. But after we finished, and we had a beautiful, beautiful chuppah, and after the chuppah was end, I decided that this is something that I want to do. And since then, it was 4 years ago, I'm working with couples who want to have a Jewish ceremony. They doesn't want to have a secular ceremony, but they want it to be egalitarian, and they do not want to register in the rabbinic court. So I'm working with them. I'm meeting them between 1 to 3 times for free. And we built together a chuppah that is very much personal, but it's very much also traditional. And I'm helping them to find figures that can perform the chuppah. And what I think is interesting is that there is a growing number of Orthodox couples who want to do it. Not secular. Yes. Orthodox people that say the way that the Judaism is present in Israel today, it's not my Judaism. We don't want to live in a contradiction between our moral standards and the way we read Jewish ideas. We want to bridge that gap, and we think we can. So I'm a single mother today, which is really sad. We didn't register anywhere, because if you do it outside of Israel and you come back, there is a agreement between the interior office and the religion office that they're going to give my name to the Rabbanut, and I don't want that to happen. So I'm a single mother.
A single married mother.
Yes.
And just to add to Chaya's story, you should know that the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington is involved in an effort to advance a civil marriage option within Israel, like going beyond or outside of the Orthodox option. This initiative, the Israel Religious Expressions Platform, or IREP, is a consortium of Jewish federations and private foundations working to encourage respect for diverse Jewish expressions in Israel. And it so happens that the first issue that IREP is tackling is the issue of the rabbinate's monopoly over Jewish marriages in Israel. They're offering grants to reform, conservative and modern Orthodox movements in Israel towards various initiatives that push for a civil marriage option. The Jewish Federation of Greater Washington sees this effort as critical to creating a more pluralistic Israeli society, open to different expressions of Jewish life. Now back to Chaya. And I understand that at the same time you've gone into catering.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. So 6 years ago, I'm old, we opened a cafe in Nachlaot, which is a really interesting neighborhood in Jerusalem, very mixed neighborhood, secular students and traditional families. And we opened a cafe, and again, we knew we don't want the Rabbanut to be involved. And we find out that religious people come to the restaurant and say to us, because they know us, there was kind of a trust relationship, and they say to us, how did you make the cake? Or like, what did you put in the soup? Did you separate between milk and meat? And because they trust us, they were sitting there with their kippot, yarmulkes, and they ate the food, even so we didn't have a kosher certificate on the wall.
And so this is kosher, non-kosher?
Yes, yes.
Or again, kosher in religious terms, but not kosher in legal terms.
Exactly, and because I was working with a waitress, and I myself cooked, and other people that we knew cooked the food, I could supervise them of how to do it halachically, but we didn't want the Rabbanut to be involved. And at the same time I was doing my MA, I was took it as a research, and I went on Jerusalem and I started interviewing businesses that used to have a kosher certificate and decided to not use them anymore. And I was asking, why did you stop using the kashrut certificate? It's business in the end. And I find out that
because quite often Orthodox customers will not go into a restaurant which doesn't have a kashrut certificate.
Right. The first thing they will do, they will not only ask if it's kosher, they would like to see the kashrut certificate. But we find out that when I start asking the places, like, how much it costs to you to, like, have this kashrut certificate? So one place say 400 shekel, another place say 800 shekel. And I was like, how come the kitchen is on the same size? And then you find out that there is a lot of corruption in the system, that you have a person that know the cousin of the owner, so he gives him half price and you pay him black, can I say that? Like under the table.
Yeah.
You pay him without receipts, so he will make like a discount to you. And many of them are, when they come to supervise, they don't even go to the kitchen. They eat muffin and drink coffee and leave and get their money. So there is a lot of problems in the system.
Aren't these kashrut inspectors on a salary from the government?
Not really. It's okay. Not, it doesn't work like that. I mean, I think it should have been, like, there should have been a regulation to this, and there should have been the same price from all the places, but it doesn't work like that. The people that come to supervise, they are the one that get the money from the owner of the cafe, which this is a halachic problem. Because once the owner pay the supervisor is not objective.
There's already a bribe.
Yes.
Implied.
So it's not even Jewishly enough. But it definitely, it's morally, it's not kosher. And the rabbi doesn't employ women to do it, which I always say to the rabbis, how come you think we should be in the kitchen? So here we have a position we can be the whole day in the kitchen. So we said, let's do something else. Let's create a system that gives a kashrut certificate, but outside of the rabbanut. We're going to have a rabbi that will supervise the entire process. We're going to have women that will be the supervisors in the cafes and the restaurants, and we're going to take the same amount of money from everyone. The way we're going to do it, it's not going to be a supervision. It's going to be working equally with the owners of the cafes, that they will be part of the process. It's not an outsider come and tell you what to do or not to do in your kitchen. You study together, you understand the rationality behind it. So to build a system that builds on trust and not on power. And we have 27 restaurants today. It was a big, big thing because now you touch the rabbinic pocket and they don't like it because it's a bit like you become like there is a competition now.
Financial competition.
Yes, yes. And we went to court. We went to the Supreme Court a few times because we can't, in Israel, you cannot use the word kasher. The word kasher,
kosher,
belong by law to the rabbinic system. So at the beginning,
they've got a copyright on the word kashrut.
Yes, good branding. And at the beginning, we created a certificate that was kashrut.
Have they got the word Jewish?
Well, apparently, yeah. But we couldn't use the word. And then, so we changed it to hashgacha pratit, which is like a private supervision.
Private providence, I think.
Nichon, I think you're right. And we didn't want to. We wanted to use the word kasher because we're ksharim, we're kosher. We couldn't. So now we have 27 restaurants. And I think for me, it's not about the kashrut system. It's about breaking the monopoly of the rabbinic court and to show that there is other Jewish ways.
So would you say that this is a religious issue or is it a political issue? It seems like you've got it in for this government body.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I do not want to live in a secular state, and I respect those who do want to live in like just a normal, let's say, Israeli place. I want to live in a Jewish place. It's my story. Like, it's something that I care about. But I think the way today it's presented in Israel, there is a big confusion about what is it to be a Jew. And sadly, 80% of the people in Israel are not religious. They never study texts. They are not involved in the ideas. So they cannot separate between what is Jewish and what is politics. Mm-hmm. To ask from a restaurant to close on Shabbat in order to be kosher, it's politics. It's not Jewish. According to the halakha, the place can be open on Shabbat and still be kosher. It's just an example. And I think what I'm trying to fight... And
right,
this,
as in if any Washingtonians find themselves wandering around Israel over Shabbat, and are looking for somewhere kosher, the only place they can go is a hotel, right?
Or like they don't have any options, and that's what I used to say.
Or it's not officially kosher. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they could, because the places that are open on Shabbat will give you pork with shrimps in a milk on Yom Kippur. It's like the extreme. And I'm saying we can have more places that are open on Shabbat and still can be kosher. So definitely what I do is politics, because but politics from a Jewish place, because I truly believe that Israel can be a place that can hold different expressions to what it is today, being Jewish.
And so if anyone's wandering around, is it just in Jerusalem or is it other places in the country?
We have other places in Tel Aviv.
And we're a tourist to look for these kind of restaurants.
So we have a website, Hashgacha Pratit, and there is a list there with all the restaurants.
Okay, and so if you look on the website of Imagine Israel podcast, you'll find the details of this website. Yeah, just to say, so the URL is shalomdc.org/Imagine Israel podcast. That's all one word. So, since we're talking about food, I'm assuming that you know about Bambi's pizza.
Yeah.
About her understanding that Israeli society is split into uncommunicative slices.
Yeah.
How would you say that these slices are split in Jerusalem? Are they only split along kashrut lines?
No. But can I change the question? Tell
yeah.
me if not.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I
yeah.
think what I really find powerful in Bambi's metaphor, she speaks about the split, but she also speaks about where we meet each other. And I think in Jerusalem, that's why I live here. And sometimes I wake up in the morning and all I want to do is to pack and move to Tel Aviv or New York. It's like, it's exhausting to live in Jerusalem, really. But what keeps me here, it's the places that we meet each other. And I think in Jerusalem, you cannot ignore the other. Like you walk, you enter the train and you are there with like Palestinian woman and Haredi woman. And we all stuck in the same carriage. Carriage. And we can choose and we can choose what we want to do with it. And I think what I find out amazingly, I was involved in one of the big issues in Jerusalem relating to the Haredi community that split the street between men and women. And I was part of like a group that went and say in
there
the
was a street in Me'er She'arim where yes. it was basically they put up signs saying women can walk on this side of the street and men can walk on that side of the street.
Yes. And I was part of a group that was saying, no, in the city that I live, I don't want to have an imaginary walls. We have enough walls between us, west and east. And we want to make sure that everyone can walk freely in the city. And what happened was that after we went to the Supreme Court and everything, a Haredi woman approached to us and say toda, and say thank you, which was so surprising. Why would they want to cooperate with like such a secular initiative? But in Jerusalem, there is, I think, surprising solidarity moments when a Haredi woman can relate to my activism as a woman much before she is religious or Jewish or something else. So I think in Jerusalem, I'm very optimistic and I find myself engaging in many spaces that I see much more solidarity than separations. So I'm with Bambi in the sense of that
the center of the pizza,
even
if you're on different slices, you've got more in common with those
in
the
center.
Yes,
and I think when she thought about it, she thought about Jerusalem. Because I think from all the places in the world, like if there is a place that it's really happening in a natural way, it's here. So when I gave birth to my first son, Michael, it was really incredible experience, not only to give birth, of course. I was in the same room with two other women, as a cliche, but it's true. I was putting in the same room with a Haredi woman and a Palestinian woman, both from East Jerusalem, one from a Haredi neighborhood and one from a Palestinian neighborhood. Both were younger than me and both had many kids.
Wow.
For me, it was the first time. So both helped me literally explaining how to feed him. And my husband and the Palestinian woman husband were like smoking cigarette outside of the room together. It was really a moment that it made me feel that it's more simple than it should be. That we make it complex. It's much more simple. And we look on our babies and they look the same. Really, I don't want to be cliche, but they just look the same. And the woman...
They all look like their grandfather.
Mamash. And the Haredi woman told me, look, they look the same now, but we're going to teach them that they are different. And it was a really sad moment. And we say, we have three kids that are literally born in the same day. They're going to share birthdays forever. And we all live in Jerusalem. And let's do something with it. And later on, what we try to do is try to bring together women, secular women, Haredi women, and Palestinian women who never really meet. and to come together, not to speak about the conflict, mm-hmm. not because it's not important, but because we think this is what the men used to do, right? The men come together and speak about the conflict. And I think what we bring as a woman is a different, is something different. And let's concentrate on what we have in common. And what we have in common is being mothers. And what funny is that many times the religious women from both communities have so much more in common than we, like with a secular, can sit and say, how we do it with one child in a career? And they were like, yeah, we have eight and we go to work, both. And I think it's there is a lot of hope there. We want to bring a new soft voice. And again, Jerusalem, this is a place to do it.
Jerusalem, the place of soft voices. Final question. Your favorite pizza topping?
I don't do pizza. I don't do cheese and I don't do white flour. But when I was in Berkeley, we had vegan pizza only in Berkeley. It was really tasty. And they had a spinach on top of it. It was wonderful.
Chagilboa. Thank you very much.
Toda rabba. Bye, Washington.
And so I leave Chaya Gilboa fascinated and inspired. How for her, the struggles in her soul became so intertwined with the struggles of the State of Israel. How the personal so naturally and inexorably became political, because how could they not? It is Israel, after all. And at the same time, I find myself excited by the way she's conducting her political battles. She's fighting a political fight, but it seems like she's using new non-combative tools. Who knows? Maybe even communities like Greater Washington or even post-election United States might benefit from this approach. And from the late Bambi Schelig's deep wisdom of her pizza of society. It may be that a separate, separated society will no longer hold, and the bridge builders are on their way. Imagine Israel podcast is created by the Jewish Federation of Greater Washington, hosted and produced by myself, Robbie Greengrass of Macom. The Imagine Israel podcast is produced every month for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at shalomdc.org/Imagine Israel podcast. That's all one word. And you can also follow Federation on Twitter at JFGW and Facebook at all one word, The Jewish Federation GW. Until next time. Just before you go, I wanted to tell you about the music that you can hear playing. I was looking for some theme music for this Imagine Israel podcast, and I was looking for something which told us a little bit about the modernity and the energy of Israel, and at the same time something about its ancient roots, and in particular its Middle Eastern roots. So I just basically just searched on YouTube for funky oud. Oud, the Middle Eastern guitarish kind of instrument. Funky oud was what I looked for, and it turns out that there is a song. This is the song that you're listening to. This song is called Funky Oud. So I looked up the musician, the person who'd created the song, to ask his or her permission to use the music for the podcast. And it turned out that it's a guy called Hisham Karma. He's a musician, creative director, and social entrepreneur, born and raised in Cairo, Egypt. And having lived in Miami, Hamburg, and Dubai, he's been influenced by multicultural experiences that shaped his mind. This is what it says in his biography on his website. So I wrote off to him and I said, please, can I, you know, is it possible to use your music for a podcast? And what royalties would I need to pay you? So I got a very swift reply, very, very friendly, and just saying, you know, if it's a corporate thing, it'll cost about $1,000. And if it's a charitable little thing, then it's about $100, $150. So I wrote back to him and I said to him, you know, first of all, thank you for replying. And certainly this is not a big corporate issue. But having said that, there's something that you should know. And I didn't know how to put this. So I just said to him, I don't want to make any assumptions about who you are and what you believe. And at the same time, I read enough of your biography, i.e. that you are born and raised in Cairo, Egypt. So I know enough of your biography to realize it might be important for you to know that while this podcast is a series of interviews that I'm holding with activists in my country who are working at LGBT rights and religious tolerance and disability rights and Jewish-Arab coexistence, I live in Israel. The podcast is called Imagine Israel and aims to shine a small light on people who are trying to make this a better place for everyone living here. And I signed off saying, you know, I don't know where this leaves you. Maybe it's not important to you at all, but maybe it is. And I just felt I should be open, you know, before I end up giving him $100 and he's put his music to something from Israel. The reply came back very quickly. Listen to this. Says Hisham Karma, well, Robbie, I'm simply an Egyptian artist who believes in coexistence and that we're all humans like one another. This is why the universal language of music had us talking now, smiley face. And here comes the killer line. Please consider Funky Oud as a gift. Use it with your podcast at no charge. And good luck, buddy, with your meaningful art. Regards, Karma. So, you're listening to Funky Oud, presented to us as a gift through the universal language of music.